The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, folks, we're going to start up again with our second panel of the morning, which is on the subject of international transparency. And we call it freedom of information or openness in government or government openness or government in the sunshine here in the United States. But overseas, the word transparency is the one that most commonly is used. As a matter of fact, I think it's fair to say that that word as a term of art has migrated back across the oceans to the United States, where now we talk more about transparency here in many different respects than we used to. That's partly because now more than 70 nations of the world have their own FOIA-like regimes. Laws that in many instances are modeled very closely on that of the United States FOIA. And it's not just a matter of proliferation of statutes overseas, but it's also a matter of effective implementation of those statutes once they are enacted. You heard discussion of implementation this morning of our own amendments, where proper implementation of the laws overseas are an important part of things as well. We're very pleased that we have Laura Newman, who made it this morning with very diligent efforts, flying up from Atlanta to present some preliminary results from the international conference, the huge international conference they had at the Carter Center just recently. And as a matter of fact, on this subject, I should mention that Tom Sussman, our legendary Tom Sussman, spoke on this subject of international transparency a bit at the Newseum at the Sunshine Program that was held there this past Friday, and Tom knew that he'd have an opportunity to elaborate on that for you here today. So what I'm going to do is just turn things over to Tom, who will moderate this panel and mention something else about each of the panelists, and then after that, we'll go right on to lunch down the corridor on the other side. And let me reiterate again, just as a logistical point, that you can leave whatever you like here as you go to lunch elsewhere on this floor and then just come right back to it. So let me turn you over to a man who I think at this point it can fairly be said needs no further introduction.
Thank you, Dan. At this point in the program, we turn from what was a fascinating morning looking at the U.S. Freedom of Information Act and its most recent amendments to what's going on in the rest of the world. And as Dan indicated, when we began, many of us began working in the U.S. On FOIA issues many years ago, there really wasn't any action in the rest of the world. Sweden had a constitution that provided a public right to access. But the U.S. was the first one there. And then a few at a time, Canada, Australia, you know, little progress. I think there were still, in 1990, only 12 countries that had access to information laws. And as Dan said, the number has hit 70 and is still growing in large part because of much of the good work being done, among others, by the Carter Center and by Will as a consultant. You know, not just UK, you know, Mexico, India, with sophisticated freedom of information laws, but Bulgaria, Zimbabwe, Uzbekistan, Albania, countries that one wouldn't expect to be at the forefront. And last year, China adopted a freedom of information national regulation. But one of the interesting things is, of course, how these countries who are late to the issue seem to have surpassed the U.S. in many of the qualities of their laws. That is, we discussed a lot this morning, Office of Government Information Services. You know, many countries have very sophisticated national commissioners, ombudsmen, offices that are extremely important in implementing the Freedom of Information Act. We have a report now from the National Security Archives, once again, on the difficulty of delay and long-term standing requests, not hearing back. Many countries, even China, you can submit your request by email. Mexico has online all of the information released under its Freedom of Information law so that everyone has access to the data released. So we'll hear about these international experiences and also some of the forces that drive them, that is not just commerce, not just NGO grassroots activity, but also from the top, a basic human rights foundation for the public's right to know. I'll introduce our three panelists in reverse order of their presentation, starting to my left with Laura Newman, who since 1999 has been with the Carter Center, extremely active in directing their Freedom of Information programs with a focus on Latin America, and most recently involved in, if those of you who knows who know what it takes to put on even a relatively small conference like this, Laura had over 140 attendees from around the world coming into Atlanta to work with each other and with former President Carter on developing sort of a future agenda on freedom of information, and she will share that with us. To her left is Nathaniel Heller, who has a different perspective. He is Director of Global Integrity, which is an offshoot for the Center for Public Integrity. And his perspective is corruption and transparency around the world. He worked for the State Department. He was a fellow on the staff of Senator Kennedy, who has a long history in freedom of information, I'm pleased to say. And he also is looking at transparency and freedom of information around the world. Will has been on the ground himself in a number of countries, advising, speaking, presenting, counseling, training on freedom of information, access to information. He got his start with the National Security Archives and filed his first Freedom of Information request, 1991.
It's not still pending, though.
I was just going to say, I don't think that's one of those that that's identified as still pending. Meredith, I hope you've tracked all of Will's old FOIA requests to make sure that they're all closed out by now, because he's gone on to other things. He's policy counsel for the International Sustainable Systems. He has been president of the Association of Access American Society of Access Professionals, ASAP. I think you were president when I was on the board, and he's been twice president, which, as he indicated this morning in his comments, is an extremely valuable venue, not just for teaching and imparting information and perspectives to the government officials who are in the trenches, but also hearing from them their concerns and questions. And we're going to start with Will, who is going to tell us a little bit about these international initiatives, how they compare to the U.S., what's going on with specific examples of the political context for these transparency developments.
Thank you, Tom. And let me thank Dan Metcalf as well for convening this conference and for convening, in fact, the first U.S. Event honoring International Right to Know Day last fall, and serving as a real focal point for these issues, both on the domestic front but also on the international front. I wanted to salute Dan on that score and just also say that I'm an American U graduate alum, so I'm glad to be back at American U, even though this is a little off the campus. But I wanted to focus my remarks today a little differently than the other panelists and address some of the political context that surrounds transparency, governance, and FOI. Because I think very often, particularly as practitioners or people in law or academia, we don't kind of look at how it sets in the U.S. foreign policy context. And that's kind of what I wanted to address today, and then perhaps can relate some of my experiences on the ground in different countries in the Q&A. So I want to kind of take a kind of a macro level a little bit. Again, this is given the length of our panel today, it's got to, by definition, be a horrible broad brush stroke. But let me just offer a few thoughts. First, why the growth of transparency? And again, I don't want to get into exact definitions, and maybe the panelists will enlighten a bit about the exact definitions. But I see kind of three main reasons why we have this growth in transparency. First and foremost in my mind as a political scientist is that we have less static international politics. The Cold War has ended, and there is an increased accountability of institutions. We used to give aid to buttress our strategic position in the world. That was the primary reason for doing so. This still occurs in the context of the global war on terrorism, but it's not everywhere. It doesn't rule in every country, nor is that assistance as one-dimensional as it once was. On top of the breakdown of kind of these rigid global blocks, there is a growth in the independence of actors, especially the rise in influence of domestic and international NGOs. So consequently, the security rationales don't hold for the assistance that was provided. And countries and multilaterals, such as the World Bank, the IMF, increasingly demand accountability for the aid that they provide. The second feature, I think, is obvious to us, is the technological advances. Over the last couple decades, we've seen the emergence of fax, which is now almost obsolete, email, video conference, telephone texting, all of these technologies. One of the things cited by national security professionals for the stability of the Cold War period was the satellites that were used to monitor the Soviet Union's ICBMs and so on. I think an interesting analogy or kind of modern-day equivalent of that occurred recently with the boat incident in the Persian Gulf with the Iran small craft circling the U.S. warships, in that the Pentagon put out their version, and then the small boats that apparently had their own video equipment in videoing their version of the engagement, and that version of the engagement then became available on the world. So to the degree that this kind of information, the technology, increases the degree of transparency of action, I think is a development. Now certainly, while advantages exist for the United States as a power as opposed to Iran or even Botswana or something like that, it is important to say that no one has a monopoly on this technology per se. A third important point, and I'll just again have to treat this very broadly, is that the globalized interdependent economy demands and depends on the free flow of information. Our world economy is increasingly information-based. Information is a commodity, in fact. We now have, call centers in the United States. You don't have to be based where the headquarters is. We have call centers in India, Vietnam, for example. Even the traditional economy relies on information to conduct business. Very importantly, transparency and anti-corruption reduce the risk for investment. And that's one of, the motivating factors, particularly in developing countries, is understanding that business will not invest if they don't understand whether the investment they would make is at risk or not. Okay. Second focus of my remarks is really where does transparency, anti-corruption, and FOI fit in U.S. foreign policy? I think, first of all, it's important to acknowledge that that there are a variety of general terms on this used in the U.S. Government, such as rule of law, transparency, good governance, anti-corruption. But it's fair to say, and I think it's important to say, that much of the foreign assistance funding that the U.S. provides has some transparency or anti-corruption component to it now. In general, Transparency, anti-corruption, and FOI are seen as part of the democratization agenda. Again, another general term. Let me just throw out to you, and I think we'll have a copy of this later, but I included a two-page summary of a web chat that I did for the Department of State. And you can get at the issues that access people are and particularly in developing countries. I was addressing questions from Madagascar, from Macedonia, a variety of countries around the world that are trying to deal with these issues of anti-corruption, development, and human rights. In terms of under the Clinton administration, democratization was as given the time frame, was in the context of the end of the Cold War. So it focused on addressing past conflicts, government repression, and corrupt institutions in order to move on. Among endeavors, the administration supported human rights commissions in many countries, in particular Latin America. Under the Bush administration, this current Bush administration, democratization was integral to U.S. strategy, in particular in the first term. And we've seen this in Iraq as one of the main justifications for war in Iraq, or secondary justifications. In the second term, his team has been much more realistic, and consequently the policies and on-the-ground implementation of democracy programs has also been much more realistic. I think it's interesting to note at this point with the Bush administration that although it has a very strong unilateralist approach toward the world, it has inculcated many of the international norms of transparency and anti-corruption put forward by the World Bank, IMF, and so on. For example, the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which is a Bush administration invention, has transparency and corruption requirements before aid monies flow to countries. And I think, interestingly, one of the more recent grantees is Ghana, which received a $500 million grant from the MCC. And I think it's interesting that the Ghana is one of the first countries in Africa to have an FOI law. Some of the indicators that the MCC requires of governments are measures are civil liberties, political rights, voice and accountability, government effectiveness, rule of law, and control of corruption. So very specifically in their guidelines. Okay, a second feature of where it sits in foreign policy. What is the architecture, if you will, look like? Where does transparency, anti-corruption, and FOI fit? Well, they're in a variety of phases. As I said, it seems to feature in a variety of areas. There are major bilateral or multilateral initiatives. From 1989, the Support for East European Democracy Act, the SEED Act, that worked with Eastern European countries in encouraging European integration. Still, in fiscal year 07, was funded at the level of $165 million. Now, that's just not FOI, obviously. We're talking about judicial oversight, a variety of programs. The Freedom Support Act, which was another legislative initiative dealing with countries of the former Soviet Union in their transition to democratic governance and market-based economies. That was funded to the tune of $293 million. In the fiscal year 07. So very substantial bilateral and multilateral programs, initiatives. And, of course, the President's Middle East Partnership Initiative, under which much of his democracy agenda for the Middle East has occurred, that was put forward in 2002. Lebanon, Egypt, Syria, countries the administration has a very strong strategic focus for their democratization. Then there are initiatives such as specially targeted funding, and again, these vary widely. For example, there was a supplemental for Iran that was provided by the Congress to the tune of $66 million in fiscal year 2006. And this is primarily for programs of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, so Radio Farda and other Persian languages programs to beam into Iran. The Middle East Partnership Initiative, Education and Cultural Affairs at the State Department, exchanges with folks in Iran. So those are the kinds of initiatives and where this kind of funding lies. There are a variety of players also in this in this in that handle this sort of thing. Of course, the Department of State is one of the lead agencies. They expend funds through their foreign assistance, through economic support funds, depending, again, on the degree of interest in U.S. foreign policy with each country. The Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement on police reform and anti-corruption. The Bureau of Education and Cultural Affairs, which sponsors exchanges, brings journalists here to the United States, supports programs on that level. The Bureau of International Information Programs, which is kind of the successor of the U.S. Information Agency and is how I have been programmed abroad when I've gone on the State Department's auspices. And certainly embassies themselves have small human rights and democracy grants that they provide on the ground to groups that are working in these areas. Then there's the U.S. Agency for International Development, which, of course, has a broad mandate of development. They expend funds on a regional and country basis. They have a whole bureau that deals with democracy and governance, which looks at all of these issues of transparency and anti-corruption. And then there's very short-term programs put forward by the Office of Transition Initiatives, which is much more on the ground in immediate post-conflict countries such as Nepal, Sudan, those countries that are coming out of years of conflict. They try and build up media and other institutions on the ground. And then there's, of course, the National Endowment for Democracy, and then a variety of other institutions such as the Department of Justice, FBI in terms of police training, even the Department of Defense, through its Partnership for Peace program, has brought officials over from Eastern European and former Soviet Union countries to learn about classification and the role of information. Now, I would say, I think a thing to think about is much of this programming, of course, depends on where these countries sit in the kind of the national interest calculus of the United States. So you have a major legislative initiative for the former Soviet Union because it's a very important strategic issue for the United States, in particular what happens to the nuclear weapons in that country. So support for these institutions, support for democracy programs are very much centered on where that falls. It's a very different sort of calculus used for the Soviet Union, for Japan, as opposed to places like Uganda or Latin American countries or Central American countries. Let me now turn to kind of a second document that I provided, and I think we'll have it after the program, after this panel, but. This is the first couple paragraphs of a reporting cable that after Dan Metcalf and I went to Japan in 1998, and it summarizes our activities and kind of the effect on the audiences that we dealt with there. I just want to read to you one of the rationale. It says justification and objective for the program. For several years running, the U.S. government has requested that the government of Japan enact an information disclosure law that would open up public access to government processes and create a more level playing field for U.S. businesses trying to compete for government contracts. Improving the transparency of the public policy process and increasing opportunities for public participation in the administrative system would be a significant step forward in achieving greater deregulation in Japan. So to give you a sense that the rationale for these programs, whether FOI or anti-corruption or transparency more generally, varies by country depending on our goal in the relationship. Just a few more points. How are these programs manifested? As I said, the Department of State's International Information Programs Bureau seems to be the one bureau that responds for requests from the ground from countries responding to local need for FOI experts and advice and so on. But the Department of State's Education and Cultural Affairs program runs specific programs called Transparency and Good Governance, in which they bring journalists, NGO leaders over, civil society to meet with a variety of people here in the United States. The Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts, for example, sends federal judges over to the countries of the former Soviet Union to train and advise in those countries. Even the Pentagon has a role. For example, in some of the West African African countries, some of the relationship between the Pentagon and those countries centers on building up the customs authority of those countries, and in fact their coast guards. Because if they don't have effective customs regimes, they can't capture money and bring money into the government. And if they don't have effective coast guards, they're being robbed of their resources, perhaps in terms of fishing and so on. So a variety, you can see where a lot of the institution building and good governance comes into play. Finally, I guess I would say that that much of this inculcation of transparency, good governance, anti-corruption is even being monitored in the last few years in the Department of State's country report on human rights practices. So it's something that not only is a requirement before we aid countries or goes into that determination for assistance, but it's also something monitored as a human rights. You can see in the 2006 country report on human rights practices, mentioned even in the two countries I was in most recently, Macedonia and Montenegro, have a description of their programs in their reports. Finally, I'll just say this final thing about kind of country snapshots, and maybe we can get into it in the Q&A. But just to say that while this is a global phenomenon, it seems to me that each incidence of FOI in these countries is due to very different conditions and motivations. That's obvious, depending on the different histories. They have different structures and different outcomes, particularly in terms of implementation. I'll just raise three issues, and perhaps this will cue it off for the Q&A. But in many countries, particularly those that were under colonial domination, there are state secrets laws that are still on the books that conflict with FOI and transparency and open government. So that's an issue that I think many countries are struggling with in implementation. Second issue is that small countries increasingly look, it seems to me, to other states and bodies in their region. I know in Macedonia and Montenegro, they're concerned with Council of Europe provisions and requirements. And they also look to Slovenia as a regional leader on FOI. And finally, I just would highlight for you just a recent decision by the FOI commissioner in the UK ordering the release of minutes concerning the Blair administration's decision-making to go to war. And I think that's an important, very important decision, particularly for countries in working in parliamentary systems, because this kind of parliamentary advice has long been something that those countries have been loath to release. And so this is a major decision, I think, that will have impact in terms of implementation on the ground in many of those other countries. So with that, I'll close and leave it to the Q&A.
Thanks, Will. Very interesting to find out how much our government is doing abroad to bring about transparency. Nathaniel has just emerged from a research project that involved 55 countries looking at the broader issues of corruption and anti-corruption regimes, and especially looking at the role of transparency and access to information as part of that. And I'm very curious. I don't want to put you on the spot because I don't know what you prepared for your 15 minutes, but the idea of being able to measure corruption, we've done that a lot, but to measure the role of transparency and access to information as a factor in combating corruption is something that I think is of special interest to the audience today. So we look forward to your comments.
No, thanks, Tom. And thanks to Dan and everyone here for setting this up and for having us. And that's a good segue into some of my remarks. What I'll try and do is get through this pretty quick and leave as much of my time as I can for the Q&A. But to pick up on that sort of prodding question, let me give you sort of 60 seconds of the kind of work we do and how it touches on this issue, and then share some of these findings, these trends, these global sort of data sets that we've compiled and how that speaks to the issues that have been discussed here. I'd also say I'm probably one of the few people in the room who's been both sort of an investigative journalist, an NGO person pushing from the outside and a FOIA responder from within the government. When I was at the State Department, I sort of accidentally became the guy who answered FOIA requests on very sensitive issues related to U.S. European nuclear policy and nuclear weapons use. And so I've seen it from both sides of the fence, which is quite interesting. And your sort of take on it, I think, is very different depending, of course, on where you sit. The work that we do at Global Integrity is, I guess, sort of a simple, although very labor-intensive work in that we work with teams of journalists, researchers, and academics around the world to generate a combination of qualitative and quantitative assessments of anti-corruption good governance mechanisms. And exactly as Tom said, we don't try and measure corruption. I think that notion has been sort of bankrupted for good reason and that it's really impossible to do. So we try and get in the back door in countries with local experts, which is to try and understand, assess, and take a snapshot of what's working and what's not when it comes to good governance and anti-corruption mechanisms. And in all of these countries we've ever done work in, we look across the entire spectrum of good governance, everything from police accountability to civil society, procurement, privatization, et cetera. But we've always looked at FOI and access to information as, I think, now one of 23 of the sort of key elements. And we break those down, all those concepts, into 300-plus indicators that are scored by local experts. So it gives us a pretty interesting snapshot. And you start to see peaks and valleys in the data in a country that starts to suggest, okay, we think A, B, and C might be working fairly well. But X, Y, and Z are not. We have good de jure laws on the books in this area, but really poor implementation. We split the data along that line. So that's sort of what we're doing, and that's what I can try and speak to today. Also, a lot of our data, in terms of our audience, why we do this work, a lot of our work is increasingly used by particularly aid donors, and Will went through a number of them, but the World Banks, MCCs, AIDs of the world are increasingly using this to get smarter about how they're programming, how they're directing money, and how they're providing assistance. We've always seen FOI naturally, given that context, as a key and integral component of any anti-corruption system in a country. That said, we don't look for a certain type of wire diagram, a certain type of program, a certain type of law. We're looking really for any sort of functional equivalence in a country, whether it's constitutional rights that are then implemented in a real way, whether it is a more formal FOIA-type legislation, whether it's regulatory, et cetera. So we try and steer away from sort of our own bias coming from the West and try and allow for all kinds of alternative mechanisms in countries. I think that all said, you know, and Laura may speak to this, you know, I think we still see FOIA as very much, you know, a fundamental human right, and you can argue it and push for it from a rights-based approach. We tend to just work at it from the sort of broader anti-corruption component. But again, I think there's a very important sort of values-based approach that has to be explored even further, especially when we're trying to leverage this on a political front. I think in terms of how FOIA fits within anti-corruption as a sort of movement or an effort, it's really, to me, it provides that deterrent effect. I think that's really the key message. And if you buy into a lot of the academic work and the practitioner experience over the years that I think was fleshed out probably most clearly by Bob Klitgaard a number of years ago, that corruption, you know, occurs and becomes worse where you have a monopoly of information with an added layer of discretion minus accountability, then you start to understand why FOI acts as a deterrent. You're able to increase accountability and reduce discretion. And I think, you know, if you buy into the idea that corruption is not a crime of passion, it's fundamentally an economic crime, or you're weighing costs and benefits. You know, I can take the bribe and I hear my risks, or I cannot and hear the penalties. FOI provides that very important layer on top to, you know, raise the bar, to provide the greater disincentive for corruption. So it's not a panacea, certainly, but I think we've seen it over time in the 75-plus countries we've worked in as an important component of any kind of anti-corruption regime. So in terms of what we just found around the world, this was our third big round of field work. We've worked over time in 76 countries. This was around in 2007 in 55 countries, working with a team of roughly 270-plus experts in these 55 countries. And what were we fundamentally looking at when it came to FOI? And again, this was a slice of the broader field work and data gathering we were doing. We were looking at just some basic de jure mechanisms, box checking, the existence of some sort of FOI regime, whether it's a basic constitutional right, again, a regulatory regime, law, et cetera, the just pure de jure existence of a mechanism that through which that could be implemented. So, you know, it's kind of great if there's a constitutional right in Article 61, but if you have no way to sort of implement it, ask for it, access it, then what's the value? So we look at that. Then we start to look at implementation and enforcement, and we try and get in there through some proxies, particularly related to time and cost. So we'll try and assess through a standardized research process the basic time and cost involved for submitting a request. We'll look at appeals process, the time and cost of the appeals process. We'll look at, you know, just the de jure existence. Is there an appeals mechanism, whether it's administrative or can you take it to the courts? We'll look at things like whether government provides rationale for denials, et cetera, all those in practice. And then what's interesting is, of course, to cut that data along the de jure and de facto line and to see where you get big gaps. And, of course, in many countries you have, and this has been shown over the years now, 75-plus countries with the right or the regime or the mechanism, but, of course, implementation is an entirely different story. In terms of FOI sort of stacking up against other anti-corruption mechanisms in all these countries, we saw it to be sort of, this is sort of a colloquial, stupid way of describing it, but kind of a middle-of-the-road problem. It's not as disastrous as, say, something like political financing, which around the world we've seen over many years is probably the most pressing anti-corruption challenge that has yet to be tackled, where you have really dismal performance in almost every country, including the G8 and the Western countries. I mean, look at this country, for instance. You know, we've had 30 years to figure it out, and we can't. FOI is not nearly that bad, but at the same time, there are clearly some major, major gaps in many, many countries. And I think it does speak to the need to really push this agenda to, really the next level. And I think there's been great awareness raising. We've had a lot of success in terms of getting laws on the books, et cetera. And I think now is really there is a tipping point where it's time to focus on implementation and enforcement. In terms of some of the countries, I sort of split the list into sort of the good and bad, just to give you a sense of where FOI is working, where it's not, as we've seen it. In terms of some of the really awful countries where it's not working so well or doesn't exist, none of these are any big surprise. Countries like Lebanon, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Sierra Leone, Tanzania, Nigeria, Algeria, Burundi, Egypt, Nepal, Kyrgyzstan, Cameroon, and Uganda. Probably not a huge surprise. Not all of those countries, though, lack a law or a right or a mechanism. Oftentimes they have that on the books, but again, there's usually a total lack of or very little implementation. And sort of the good side of the ledger, I think this is actually more interesting in terms of the mix of countries and speaks to a lot of other work that's been emerging in the last several years that points to a lot of newer democracies doing much better at FOI, and Tom touched on this. So in that category, you have countries like Colombia, India, Mexico, Spain, Japan, Romania. In a funny way, Thailand, although it's a very weird situation now given the sort of post-coup climate, Ukraine, Jordan, Turkey, Bulgaria, France, and Italy. So sort of the traditional G8 Western countries you'd expect, but on the flip side, some of the very newer democracies like Romania or Bulgaria. And I think that, again, goes back to the idea that what's very useful in this sort of work, I think, is to get away from perceptions work and sort of, and I think you can design good polls, but if you just go out and poll with simplistic questions and ask even citizens in their own country, is FOI good or bad, you likely are pulling in a bunch of sort of legacy, sort of subconscious sentiments where, you know, if you poll a bunch of Bulgarians, I can almost guarantee the data that comes out of that is skewed negatively because everyone's thinking about 10 or 15 years ago and probably aren't reflecting some of the reforms that have been made recently. And on the flip side, if you go out and poll Americans, you'd probably maybe get a more positive response than what some of the recent experience has suggested. To wrap up, I thought it'd be it's just an interesting test for me. I wanted to take a quick poll of the audience a very informed audience on these issues to just see how close or how far we were collectively from this sort of basic answer. So if nobody minds, just a quick show of hands. Here's the question. In which of the following five countries, this is sort of an FOI / disclosure question, in which of the five following countries are the asset disclosures of certain members of the national legislature, either Congress or Parliament, confidential and by law unavailable to the public? And your choices are, in alphabetical order, Bulgaria, Canada, Kyrgyzstan, Philippines, and Romania. So I'll give 6 seconds for everyone to think about this. So go down the list. So again, there's only one here where certain members of the national legislature are exempt from this sort of disclosure. So how about hands for Bulgaria? Okay. Canada? Okay. Kyrgyzstan? Philippines? And Romania? All right, so the majority of the hands were the Philippines and Canada. Canada is the right answer, and I think, you know, obviously it's a very smart audience, so probably the wrong one to do this cliche-ish trick with. But It points to the reality that the next generation of this work, which is how I'll wrap up, is really, I think, going to be about rolling up our sleeves, digging really deep into country-specific context. Will touched on this. That's, I think, a really key theme that, I mean, the kind of cross-national work that even we do and a lot of other groups do is really important for highlighting trends, but the solutions will be nationally specific, they'll be country-specific, they'll be sub-nationally specific, especially in large federal states. We're starting to move into that area too, working with teams at the sub-national level. And I think that's really where a lot of the reforms are going to come from, is sort of unpacking the black boxes, unpacking a lot of the assumptions, and getting down to some really country-specific ideas. So with that, I'll wrap up.
In the category of tell me something that I don't know, I learned recently that the deliberations of the Supreme Court of Mexico are publicly available online. All right, I didn't say opinions, I didn't say oral arguments, but they're conference deliberations. Interesting. I mean, some countries actually go way beyond anything that we've heard of. And I think the Canadian experience, by contrast, is, I mean, some countries that we would expect to be way beyond where we are, because they are in many areas relating to freedom of information, are lag behind Kyrgyzstan. Laura is really one of the world's experts on the issue of access to information as a fundamental human right. It plays an important role in Latin America, where she does a lot of her work. She's going to talk a little bit about that and about how this group of 140 representatives from around the world were able to translate a tremendous diversity of experience and, for many, lack of experience with open government into a set of principles and mandate for moving forward. Laura?
Thank you. Thanks again to the organizers from American University, from the Collaboration on Government Secrecy, and, of course, Dan Metcalf, for inviting me to present at the first annual Freedom of Information Day celebration. I also want to thank our esteemed and congratulate our esteemed moderator, Tom, and also the other panelists for their comments. And happy St. Patrick's Day to everybody. It's great to see a few people wearing green. I was telling Meredith this morning from Atlanta very early, and I had to drop off my 2-year-old at someone's house to take her to daycare because it hadn't opened yet. And I called her when I arrived to see if everything went well, and she said to me, "You know what today is, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah, Monday." And she said, "No, it's St. Patrick's Day. Your daughter is the only one wearing red in a sea of green, so I'm hoping she's not being pinched." As a caveat, as Tom mentioned, I'm not going to be talking specifically about anti-corruption. I'm really going to focus on access to information, and it's more transversal use, particularly that of as a human right. And as you said, I'm privileged to direct all of the Carter Center's work with relation to transparency and the right to access to information. The Carter Center, as some of you may know, is a non-governmental organization. We are headquartered in Atlanta, Georgia, and it's led by former President Jimmy Carter and his wife, Rosalynn. We work in over 70 countries around the world on issues related to democracy, human rights, conflict prevention and resolution, transparency, and health-related issues. We began working on the right to information in Jamaica in 1999, and at that time it was part of an anti-corruption portfolio. However, we soon recognized that the value of access to information goes well beyond its role in fighting corruption. Democracy depends on a free flow of information, and as Tom mentioned, increasingly developed and developing countries around the world are recognizing this fact. Access to information serves to increase transparency in government, and as Nathaniel said, to make government more accountable to the people. But it also makes the public administration itself more efficient and effective. It allows citizens to participate in public life by determining their own priorities and informing government decisions. And perhaps most importantly, and the reason that I've been so passionate about this, not just since 1999, but also 7 years before when I was practicing law in Wisconsin as a public interest lawyer, the right to information is a fundamental human right, and it's critical to the exercise of other rights. rights, such as the right to clean water, education, and health care. And just to go back to my time as a public interest lawyer, we used to use our open government laws and the Freedom of Information Act all the time to get information about why some groups of women received benefits and others didn't, why certain decisions were being made related to Medicare or Medicaid. And so for me, it was such an obvious link to the work that the Carter Center does in human rights and socioeconomic rights. In the past, access to information was seen as a subsidiary of the right to freedom of expression, but not really as a right in and of itself. Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, a section that focuses on freedom of opinion and expression and is often seen as a right for the media, says that everyone, and this is just a quote from the Declaration, everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference, and this is the key part, and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media and regardless of frontiers. Article 13 of the American Convention on Human Rights, entered into force in 1978 and signed onto by all members of the Organization of American States, which is basically all countries in the Americas, including Canada and the United States, except for Cuba. And that contains almost the exact language of Article 19, with the most relevant phrase being the same, the freedom to seek, receive, and impart information. Although over the past decade, advocates for the right to information have argued that these international instruments provide an independent right of freedom of information, in addition to the right of freedom of expression, it was not until September of 2006 that an international court actually ruled on this issue. In the seminal case of Claude Reyes versus Chile, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights found that the words seek and receive created a protected right of freedom of information, including the right to request specific information from a government and the government's duty to respond. In the decision, the court further found that the freedom of opinion and expression contemplates a simultaneous right of freedom of access to information. So for the first time, those of us who had been advocating this finally had an instrument, a law decision that we could point to say that there was, in fact, a right to freedom of information. The regional court ruled that Chile and all states that have acceded to the Convention on Human, the American Convention on Human Rights, must do four things. They must, one, guarantee the protection of the right to information. They must have effective administrative procedures to handle requests and provision of solicited information. There must be time limits for handling information requests. I wish they had added and that those were acceded to, but and there must be properly trained public officials to manage the access to information regime. This decision was a great advance in the area of the right to information, but there were still over 100 countries without access to information laws, some countries in retreat, notably the United States, Ireland, and Australia. I wasn't here this morning, so I'm not sure exactly what was said about the U.S., but we really have a dismal record in many cases. And it's interesting as someone who works in Latin America, Caribbean, but I also work in Africa, to be able to point to some of the difficulties that we see in the U.S. case to help other governments to move forward. But it's not just the U.S. In Ireland, a few years ago, they changed the cost requirements, and they've seen a 70% decrease in the number of requests for information because the cost went up so greatly. And as well, we've, as other people have said, have seen incredibly uneven implementation of the right to information in those countries with an established statutory framework. Although there were some exciting new developments, such as China's passage of an open government regulation, there was also a slowdown in passage of new laws, and worse, as Nathaniel mentioned, little emphasis on ensuring that already passed laws were in fact functioning in practice. In considering this situation and our experiences, it seemed that two things had happened early on in the development of the right to information. And let me also add that vigilance is really critical as well. We were seeing laws being passed, but in some cases they were incredibly restrictive laws where the government would just slap on the title access to information. In Zimbabwe, which Tom mentioned, was a perfect example. In fact, recently it was invoked to put a journalist in jail because they said, oh, we're using the access to information law to do it. Well, in fact, it was an incredibly restrictive law which sanctions anybody for actually trying to access information. But we've seen other things, regulations like Panama and a law in Paraguay, which were equally bad. And so it really does take some vigilance. But we had seen sort of two things happen over the last decade. One, we as a community had become incredibly focused on the technical aspects of drafting a law without, I felt, sufficient focus on the politics of information. What are the incentives and the disincentives to establishing a right to information regime? Who are our friends, who are our allies, and who are our foes? And how could we change the mindset of those foes? I think it's great. William talked a lot. Will talked a lot about looking at the context in each country and finding what was important in that country. I can't agree with him more. I think we needed to go even further. And really look at how do you go from passing a law, which is relatively easy, to really putting it into practice. And I think the second part, and I apologize given the title of this panel, is that we allowed ourselves to be pigeonholed into the anti-corruption field. And rather than consider access to information more broadly as a transversal tool for good governments, for socioeconomic rights, for development, for investment, as a human right, we went along with this, we're a tool for anti-corruption, and it is. But when you stop there, you create all kinds of problems for oneself. And a couple of the problems that we've seen is that, again, as we said earlier, once the laws were passed, we didn't really know how to get governments over the hump to putting the resources there in order to implement those laws. Governments, especially in our region in Latin America, started to fear the idea of access to information. We spent so much time telling them that this was part of the anti-corruption field that they stopped seeing why this was beneficial for them. And worse, we ourselves bought into that, and so we stopped finding allies outside the anti-corruption field. And so where lots of people who are working on women's issues or on children's issues or healthcare issues, any number of issues, would have been our natural allies in using these laws once they were passed and making them valuable in practice, they didn't see it as part of their constituency. So having looked at a number of those problems, and then we looked at what was going on in our world today, we were concerned that those working to promote and the passage of access to information, as I said, were ourselves becoming too siloed, and that the world had changed greatly since we began this promotion of the right to information a decade ago. Some of this was since September 11th. A lot of it was using September 11th as the excuse. But national security concerns were increasingly used to trump rights to information. Technology advances were occurring faster than policy was responding, and we recognized if not harnessed properly, could actually impede the right to information. Power has seeped from the state to all bodies, all kinds of non-state actors, such as private companies through privatization, and also the international financial institutions. And the focus on civil political rights had been overtaken by the concentration on socioeconomic rights and the need to ensure that persons enjoy the full range of citizenship rights, particularly those of social inclusion and development. Okay, when you put all of those together, we decided to hold a conference. And anybody who's ever heard President Carter speak or knows anything about President Carter knows that he despises conferences. And so in order to get him to agree to be a part of a conference and to host one, you have to really argue that this will be action-oriented, that it will advance and move forward whatever the field is. And we were lucky enough to convince him of that. And so in the end of February, from the 27th to the 29th, we organized the International Conference on the Right to Public Information. And as Tom said, in attendance were well over, really at various points, close to 150 participants from over 40 countries. And they represented all the key stakeholder groups. We had people from government, former presidents, about a dozen or so ministers or vice ministers, civil society representatives, donors, private sector, international financial institutions, multilateral and bilateral organizations, the media, and academia. And what we did was put them in groups together to really start talking to one another in a way that may not have happened in the past. Again, going back to this, how do we understand the incentives and disincentives? We needed to sit together and consider that. At the conclusion of the conference, we are finalizing the Atlanta Declaration and Action Plan for the Advancement of the Right to of Access to Information. We hope to present it officially, maybe even by the end of this week, to commemorate U.S. Sunshine Week. But I wanted to just go over really quickly some of the findings, some of our principles, and just a few of the action points. And Dan, I will make sure that once we've actually, President Carter has released it, it comes to you and you can maybe distribute it to all of the participants or at least get it up on your website. Fantastic. Some of the findings are that the right of access to information is inherent in all cultures and systems of government, and that a lack of access disproportionately affects the poor, women, and other marginalized groups. When I go and work abroad, one of the very first things that I say is that the right to information is not for the elite. If we're honest with ourselves, the elite have access to information. They know how to get it. And it's not for the media, because the media have sources. What this right is for the people on the street who have no other way to get in that public building and get the information they need to transform their lives. Right to information is fundamental to human dignity, to equity and peace with justice, and it's foundational for democracy. An important point, and one that we went over a lot as we were preparing this document, is the role of transparency for security. And we didn't want to be so blunt as to say you have to have full transparency in order to have security, but at the same time we recognize that having secrecy actually serves to undermine security. We're still working with the phrasing, but basically the idea is that transparency enhances security. And that the importance of focusing, as we've done today, not just on passing laws, but also on their full implementation and effective enforcement. Some of the principles that we began with were, as we talked today, the right to information is a fundamental human right, and that all states should enact legislation to give effect to this right. That it's great to have the right framed in the Constitution, but if it ends there, then in practice, people don't actually get information, that you need to have some kind of statutory framework for it. That the right applies to all parts of government, all organs. You probably heard this morning in the United States it only applies to the executive branch. Our principle is it should apply to all branches of government, both national and subnational, and also all intergovernment organizations, including the international financial institutions and the multilateral bilateral bodies. That the right applies to non-state actors as well. So it applies to the private sector when they receive public funds or benefits, whether that's directly or indirectly. If they're getting lots of tax concessions, well, then we as citizens should know about that. We should have a right to request information about that. If they carry out public functions or if they exploit natural resources. And this was actually probably the most contentious part, I know, of the working group Tom was in, but maybe even of the conference itself. We finally have decided to include in our principles that the right to information should extend to large profit-seeking corporations when that information is required for the exercise or protection of a human right. So as information seeps to these large corporations, if we look at someone, and there was someone there from GlaxoSmithKline, pharmaceutical company, but their budget is larger than most budgets of countries in Africa and Latin America. They hold a lot of information that we as citizens of the world really need. Some of the action plans to advance the right to information, we divided these into points of action for different stakeholder groups. So we have some action points for the international community, such as intergovernmental organizations and the World Bank, and development banks, and also a number of points for donors. So in our action plan for the future, we call on the international and regional bodies to take measures to ensure that all states have effective mechanisms to promote and protect the right, and to develop international instruments on the right to access to information. That international donors should ensure sufficient long-term funding in support of the state's efforts to establish, implement, and enforce right of access to information, and that donor funding agreements should include terms requiring that recipients agree to provide access to information regarding the amount and use of international funds. At present, you're probably not surprised to know that if the World Bank gives money for certain projects in countries, that that information is not necessarily available either through the country or the World Bank, as they point to each other saying it's each other's information. For the states, every state should provide for the right of access to information in keeping with a set of principles and tenets that we actually put into our declaration, that states should integrate promotion of the right to access to information in their own national development and growth strategies, and that states should establish independent enforcement mechanisms, such as Tom, I think, mentioned information commissions, that allow for accessible, affordable, and timely appeals procedures. And finally, we looked at the corporate, professional, and civil society organizations and called on the multinational corporations and large domestic businesses to take steps to put into place voluntary commitments to proactively disclose information. Some of those might be the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative. There's some new ones around medicines and construction where they're just putting information out there. That the access to information community should strive to build solidarity with a full range of stakeholders who share a common transparency agenda, and that civil society should ensure full enjoyment of the right to access to information by demanding and using information and promoting and defending the right. As I say, once we've had consent by all participants on the document, it will then be given to President Carter, who will release the declarations, and we certainly will make it distributed widely. I want to thank you again for the opportunity to discuss not just the Carter Center Conference and this declaration, but perhaps most importantly, to expand a little bit of our thoughts around the right of information to that as a fundamental human right for all citizens of the world. Thank you.
Lest you think that that's an aggressive agenda, I would remind you that the Carter Center in partnership with others, has nearly eliminated river blindness in Africa at former President Carter's initiative. And so here he's focusing his sights and the sights of the center on another kind of blindness that infects countries all over the world.
Well, I'm going to use that. I have to give a presentation tomorrow to our Board of Trustees and President. I'm quoting that.
Oh, good. That's S-U-S-M-A-N.
He's a legend.
Yeah. In any event, I just have one quick question for each of our panelists, and then I want to go to questions from the floor, because this is bound to have provoked a number of areas that you'd like to proceed. And my question is a simple one. We're not bound, like so many critics of the Supreme Court would like them to be, in terms of looking to foreign precedents and foreign countries for guidance. But pick a country, each of you, that the United States could learn the most from, for whatever reason you think. Because many of us are here, we're sitting in this room today because we are interested in what's going on around the world. And so it's one thing to sort of do a survey, but it's another thing to tell us, where do we look to learn something that we can then import into our own country? I'll start over with Will.
I hope I hit a home run with this with the audience, but because this Office of Government Information Services is such a key element of the current FOIA amendments here in the United States, that I think one of the areas that we could look at would be the Canadian Information Commissioner. In particular, their mediation focus. Now, obviously, we're talking about two very different societies. Ours is very much contentious, litigation-driven, and the Canadians a much more consensus-oriented society. But I think the fact of where that information commissioner sits, the powers that the information commissioner has, the legacy that they've established in terms of legislative recommendations and encouraging agency compliance, is, I think, one to really send to be a model for us that we can learn from, particularly because of it being such a close neighbor of ours. I think, and one of the reasons I say it might be fruitful as well is I have a sense that, again, because of my recent discussions with agency personnel in the U.S., is that there's such an exhaustion in effect because of the lack of resources and training and so on within the U.S. agencies, that the mediation aspect is in fact looked upon very as perhaps a welcome development. And so I think even given the differences, it might be a welcome model.
Excellent. Nathaniel?
If I had to choose one, if I can choose sort of a region, I think former Warsaw Pact in Eastern Europe is very interesting in terms of specifically the amount of proactive disclosure. So, I mean, you can go, when you go on the lunch break, go on to Bulgarian or Romanian government websites and pull out all sorts of really pretty good stuff, I think a lot more than we typically get here. And, of course, then the applicability across government, and then just the kooky limitations we have here with not applying to the legislature, and other branches of government just don't make much sense. And I think some of these countries have gotten that right. So I would sort of vote for Romania, Bulgaria, Poland, those sorts of places.
Interesting. Laura? If any of you want to take the microphone. I've got other questions, but we'd love to hear from you.
I have to say I'm unconvinced by my colleagues, although I do really like Bulgaria. I think they've done some great stuff. My worry about Canada is that even the information commissioner, former John Reid, had said for a period it was fine to not have binding powers, to just be able to recommend. But as the culture in Canada has shifted, he was finding it increasingly unnerving not be able to actually bind his decisions on somebody because he felt that they were ignored. So I'm going to say that my favorite is South Africa and India. And South Africa, because of the breadth of coverage within the law, in that it covers the non-state actors in a very, I think, exciting way. It hasn't worked so well in practice, but I think it's a very exciting trend, modernization of the right to information. In India, because they never saw this as just important to one aspect of governance or another, but have in fact very much on the ground used it to support whatever initiative or campaign they were working on in a grassroots way, whether it was about getting health care or getting wells and clean water to remote communities, or about getting equal pay. They've really taken on this issue, and India is obviously huge, so I'm talking about various regions of India, not India as a whole, although they now do have good national legislation, but just really the way that it's been used in practice. And I guess I would generally say Mexico, but I think that we're starting to see a few chinks in the armor in the Mexico case. And it's so new. It's hard. You know, there's not generations to know how these are actually functioning. All of these laws were passed since 2000. So, but those would be my bets for different reasons.
Interesting. Do we have any questions from you? I'll continue to filibuster until lunch if you'd like. We do.
I don't know if any of you have looked into one very peculiar instance of access or expropriation of government information, and that's that this recent announcement that there's this huge chunk of Iraqi government documents that are now going to be in the custody of Stanford for some indefinite period, allegedly to provide greater access than had they been placed in the Iraqi archives.
I'd be happy to take a step. I'd not seen that specific report, but let me, I guess, because I made mention of Iraq, that's why I want, as part of the democratization initiative, and I guess this is where when it gets fuzzy on the whole democratization piece, because it would seem to me if we were interested in organic development of democracy within these countries, we would leave those kinds of documents there and build up the National Archives, a National Museum, work with NGOs there, and there are people there. It was a learned Arab society. There are PhDs there and universities and so on that could certainly buy, with a modicum of security and political stability, make good use of that information. So I think it actually speaks to the origins of the democratization notion with the administration's policy on Iraq, rather than whether it's a fruitful thing for Iraqi democratization.
Yes, ma'am.
Laura mentioned the goal of working with large profit-seeking organizations, and several of you have touched on the corporate role in bribery, anti-corruption. What, if anything, do the three or four of you see as the future for transparency as it applies to multinational corporations, particularly when we see the problems with supply chain issues such as in China and elsewhere, and the related issues where you have more and more of the same, sometimes government-run, sometimes private corporations contributing to health, environmental, and other issues which are corporate, not government, and affecting the global economy?
Well, let's start on with somebody else on that. That's a great question. It's Laura, why don't you sort of sat through some of the discussions, and this was a highly controversial
issue during the discussions at the Carter Center, but also I think out of it did come a sense that there was a role to play imposing an access regime on the private sector. The, much of the debate was, you know, where to draw the line.
Yeah, thank you. Absolutely. And you were in that group, and I unfortunately just was flitting in and out. But, you know, I think we have to start with this notion that the private sector should not be immune, that we create private corporations for our own regulations, and as such, we can also create some form of transparency within the private sector through regulation. So I think, you know, we need to, first of all, take the gloves off in the sense that they are not gods. You know, and that just like we expect certain things from our government, we should have the right to expect certain things from corporations that do have so much influence. I think what we're increasingly seeing in legislation around the world as new laws are passed is that when companies receive public funds, that money, the amount of public funds that are giving to them and the way that those public funds are being used, whether it's through actual dollars or through concessions, should be open. There should be transparency around that. I think that's pretty much agreed these days. When they're providing public services, our jails are increasingly being privatized. Does that mean that we shouldn't have information about jails? Our electric around the world is increasingly being privatized, or our provision of water. So a second sort of generation of information that we're seeing, or companies that we're seeing covered by freedom of information laws, are those who provide public services. This issue of natural resources is relatively new, but anybody who has, and all of you probably, I'm sure, have studied, especially with our interest in Iraq these days, is the role that natural resources can play in conflict. And so increasingly we're trying to promote transparency around the extractive industries. How much are companies paying government? How much is government receiving? And then what are they doing with those resources, particularly in conflict areas? I think the one, and so that's a bit new, but the real issue are those multinational corporations, and when they hold so much power and so much information. And so what the group, at least in Atlanta, came up with was this construct that when they have information that is necessary for a human right, for you to exercise a human right as dictated within the Bill of Human Rights, International Bill of Human Rights, which is the UN Declaration of Human Rights and a few other key instruments, when there's information around that, it shouldn't matter who holds that information, whether it's a government or a multilateral organization like the World Bank or the UN. It shouldn't matter if it's Coca-Cola. If it's information that you need to exercise a human right, you should be able to request that. And there should be some clear limits. It shouldn't be so onerous on the company to make it impossible. And we do talk in the document about some of those limitations. There should still be exceptions to that. But that kind of information that you need to exercise your other rights, right to assembly, for example. I think a great example, and I don't know if your group talked about this, was the case of Coca-Cola in Colombia, where they're being sued by union organizers. I think that would be a case where maybe some of the information that Coke holds, and let me say, I'm from Atlanta. Coca-Cola funded our conference. My brother's lead counsel at Coke, one of the lead counsels at Coke. But I do think that increasingly we need, as citizens, to have access to that kind of information. And so we did include that in our declaration. How we put that into practice is a matter for all of us as we advocate and continue to advocate for the right to information.
Did anyone elaborate on that? That was a pretty good answer. Nathaniel?
I was just going to just add a quick comment in that. it was very good.
Thank you.
Excellent.
You know, I think there's a lot more work that has to be done in terms of how do you push that agenda. You know, I think there's a lot of work that has to be done to show the linkage between good governance or FOI or you know, anti-corruption generally, and better returns on capital and investment. And I think there's been a lot of assumptions. That sort of myths that have been put out there for good reason and for all the right reasons to try and demonstrate that, you know, if you go to better behaved countries, you'll do better financially with investments. I'm not sure that's there. In fact, our own data has shown a negative correlation. Right? So capital is flowing to countries with worse governance, worse anti-corruption mechanisms. So what does that say? I think it does say that I think most people in this room, and I certainly include myself in this, are so far from understanding the decision making that goes into those investments. And we're just starting now some interesting outreach work with big hedge funds that work in emerging markets. And to try and understand the thought process that goes in there and to how those decisions are made, I think we'll unpack a lot of how we get at that agenda and how we can really push it forward. So I'm 100,000% supporter of it, but I think we have to do a lot of actually better homework to somehow empirically or quasi-empirically demonstrate some of those linkages so we start to really get at the motivations behind a lot of those capital flows. I mean, China's a great example, right? Yeah. You know, you can't pour enough money into China right now, not exactly the cleanest government or governance climate.
I've received a cut sign from our fearless leader, but we did have someone standing at the microphone during the entire answer, so why don't we have one last question. And in any event, Judge Lamberth has been standing up back for about 10 minutes. It's really good for him to sort of listen to. We'll listen to him, so just bear with us.
This is a question for anyone.
He's in the midst of a criminal trial right now.
All right, well, go sit. We'll be in. We have one question, and we'll answer it within a minute. Well, just keep him safe back there.
This is for anyone. For countries seeking to enact FOIA as new countries, what's the strongest driving force, either battling corruption or promoting democracy?
That's like, you know, taste light, more filling, or whatever.
I think this point was raised by Laura's presentation for me, which is, anti-corruption is a term viewed very differently. It's viewed in a certain way in Washington, D.C. It's viewed very differently in those countries. Anti-corruption there is about democratization. And so you'll see that in the web chat. All of that use the term, but what they're talking about is literally accountability, open of decision-making, and so on. So I would say it's about that. It's about openness of government so people – it's about citizen participation is what it is.
Well, we're going to have plenty of time after our luncheon speaker to discuss this subject further around the tables and during the break time. So let's thank our panelists for a great presentation.